I'll just say, this is an interview with Lawrence Adelson, who was the director of Extension and the dean of Extension for a while, and then the chancellor of the university system. And this is January 6th, I think, or is it the 5th, 1983. I'm Laura Smale, and we're talking in his house. Let's just to begin with, I would like to know what sort of background you came from.
Well, I grew up in Chicago. Disadvantaged parents. My father was a carpenter. In those days, he rarely worked between Thanksgiving and Easter. And consequently, winters, especially the Christmas time, was rather tough on us. But I graduated from high school there and went to work. And then, about three and a half years later, I went to what was then Crane Junior College. It was Chicago's first two-year college, post-high school college.
Hold on. What made you go to college?
Oh, I wanted to go to college. I was a very bright student, and although I really didn't have much thought of going at the time I graduated from high school, but I'd been urged by teachers in high school and friends to try to get to college. But I couldn't see my way clear until some 3 years after I had graduated from high school.
Hmm. Were your parents, did they support you in going to college, or were they interested in your going?
Well, they were very much interested, but they couldn't afford to support me.
I meant support you.
Though I lived at home
mentally.
That first year. And then through one of my instructors at Crane, I got a scholarship at Wabash College in Indiana. Hmm. And I went to Wabash for 3 years, since I'd had 1 year in Chicago. And again, while I would have liked to have gone on to graduate school or professional school, I didn't see my way clear. I graduated in that wonderful year of 1933.
Oh.
There were no jobs, and I looked for maybe 2 months and then decided to do what I thought at that time was original, but I've since learned that many people did that. That is, send out a vita with a letter to some 50 presidents of major companies in Chicago. Actually, it worked for me because through it I got a job at Carson Peary Scott & Company in their wholesale house. In fact, after I'd been there working about 2 weeks, I was put in charge of a women's lingerie factory that they had down in one corner of the big building, and worked there for some three and a half years, which was a fascinating experience from many points of view. Well, then things got a little better at home financially, and my parents decided that if I wanted to go to graduate school, I should. And so in the fall of 1936, I came up here to Wisconsin.
What made you want to go to graduate school?
Oh, I wanted to be a teacher.
Oh.
Yeah.
A college teacher.
College teacher, if possible. So I came up here in the political science department, did graduate work for, well, more or less full time for 2 years, And then I got a job in extension, grading correspondence study papers. And so I did that and also began lecturing out in the state for extension. And then I kept taking some graduate work. It took me another 2-3 years, though, to complete the PhD degree. I continued on an extension, and shortly after I got my degree, then President Dykstra called me in, and he was a big, hearty fellow, and he blustered around all over the lot, and didn't have the foggiest idea why he wanted to talk to me. I'd never met him before. And for about an hour, he talked about all kinds of things and asked me questions and whatnot. And then he got up and he said, "Well, sure been nice to talk with you." I took that as a signal to leave, which I did. And by golly, the next day he called again, said he wanted to talk with me. So I went over, and then he was more businesslike. He asked me whether I'd like to be an administrator. Well, I said, "No, not particularly. I'd like to be a professor, but I don't care too much about administration." "Well," he said, "you ought to take a shot at it anyway. I'm going to appoint you head of extension," which I must say really surprised me. A lot of other people too.
Well, it is extraordinary. Have you any idea what was the line of events?
I was going to come to that. My major professor, technically not, but in actuality, my major professor was John Goss in political science. And he and I were good friends too. And he was Dykstra's closest personal friend. And Goss told me this story years later. He said he and Dykstra were visiting one evening, and Dykstra said, "You know," he said, "I've got real trouble over in the extension division. I'm going to move the present dean out of the job, but," he said, "I don't have any idea who to replace him with." Goss says, "I've got just the man for you." And so Goss told him about me, and Dykstra said, "Well, I'll talk with him," which he did, and not too long afterwards I had the job.
Now were you 40?
No, I was 35.
35, I was just trying to remember
I'm pretty sure I was 35.
Yeah. What was wrong with Holt? It was Holt.
Holt, yeah.
That you replaced. What was wrong
Frank
with him?
Holt. He didn't know much about extension to begin with. And while he did a great deal of work out in the state, while he was dean and even more later, he didn't seem to have a feeling for what extension could do. Extension was in rather bad shape. All it was a correspondence study program at that time. It had been many things earlier, but they had all been sloughed off and dropped.
I thought that during the 30s they had set up the freshman-sophomore centers, many of them.
They were started in, about 33. Mm-hmm. They had a number of them, but they were small, all housed in vocational schools at that time.
So they weren't really significant?
No. No, they became significant after World War II,
yes,
when you had this tremendous group of veterans returning.
So Dykstra felt that the whole, and was Dykstra himself particularly interested in extension?
I don't think so.
But somebody must have been, the regents, or do you know who?
No, the only person I relate to that is John Goss, who wasn't particularly interested in extension either,
yeah.
Except he was very much interested in me.
But I mean, why Dykstra should have decided that he had to replace Frank Holt? What I wonder.
Well, he just didn't think that he was fitted for the job. He made him registrar in the university, and he was very good at that.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, in any case, I was suddenly had a very peculiar title. He gave me the title Acting Associate Director. Well, the acting was understandable.
Mm-hmm.
I got the associate directorship because that was the title of the head of Ag Extension.
Oh, I see.
And at that time, Dykstra had some notion about tying the two together someday. And he thought it would be wise for the heads of the two to have the same title. So I had this acting associate director title, not for very long, because Dykstra left, oh, I guess within 6-7 months after I had been appointed, and E.B. Fred came in.
Can you describe what it was like suddenly starting to take on a big job like that, which you hadn't thought of before? How did you go about it?
I didn't think much about it, tell you the truth. I just went down there and started working.
Well, what'd you start doing?
Well, first of all, of course, I had to acquaint myself with the... Well, first I had to get a secretary because Holt's secretary went with him to his other job. So I had to get a secretary. Mrs. Alice Sater. And then I, set about just learning the ins and outs of what we were doing, getting acquainted with the personalities.
Of course, you must have known quite a few of them already.
Oh, yes, yeah, I knew quite a few. And then I started thinking about what to do with this organization.
Excuse me. There's music going on, isn't there?
Yeah, my wife's upstairs. Are you catching it in there?
I guess not.
I wouldn't think so.
It might be a good idea if you were to hold this closer, and then when I ask a question, if you could sort of point it at me.
Okay.
Because it will come, your voice will come through better. So, excuse me, go ahead then.
One thing that happened before President Dykstra left, however, involved the School for Workers. He called me in one day and asked me if I knew anything about workers' education, or more specifically, the School for Workers. Well, I told him no, I'd never even heard of it. Well, he said, I'm running it out of my office here. And he said, I don't think I should be doing that. And I said, I don't think so either. You've got no business running any unit of the university of that kind. So he said, I think it belongs in extension. I said, it probably does. So he put me in touch with Schwarzstrauber.
Yeah.
And we talked over what they were doing and what they perhaps could do, and so I agreed that Extension would take on the School for Workers, and Dykstra transferred its budget to ours, and that was the start of a long and very happy association.
But I guess that's close enough.
Oh.
What kind of a person was Schwarzstrauber?
Schwarzstrauber was an idealist, a dreamer. He had just great visions for and great hopes for workers' education. But he wasn't much of an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
And the image, if you want to call it that, of the School for Workers was not a very good one. But
In whose eyes?
Oh, in the eyes of the administration.
I mean, how about the labor unions? How did they look on it?
I think their feelings were mixed. Generally, they looked well on it. I mean, any program in workers' education looked good to them, but again, I'm not quite sure that how well they liked Schwarzstrauber.
Mm.
I'm not sure
yeah.
on that. But in any case, we then slowly developed it. They had no class program in the state, and I insisted that they do that.
They just had the summer school sessions?
The summer school, that's, mm-hmm. yeah, that was their whole program. And they started the class program, which has been quite successful. And then Schwarzstrauber died, and let's see. Well, I'm not quite sure.
Well, there's Ulrichsen.
Ulrichsen, yeah.
It's interesting that at one point Ulrichsen was the associate director but was getting $5,000, and Schwarzstrauber was the director and was getting $4,000.
Yeah, yeah.
What was that about?
I don't really know.
You didn't know it at the time? Because this was in 1947, I think. Yeah.
Oh, it was. Well, then it was under Extension. That
yeah.
Yeah.
It looks very odd.
No, I don't remember that. Well, in any case, I don't recall whether Ulrichsen was the director for a time or not. But not too long thereafter, we got Bob Ozan. And we got him through Bob Fleming, who was a friend of who knew him, at least.
Not through Ed Young.
Well, Ed Young was involved, too, but Fleming at that time was head of the, I think they called it an Industrial Relations Center.
Yes.
That had a rather short life here. And he was the one who recommended Bob Ozan. I'm sure I talked to Ed Young about it.
So, but it was you who hired Ozan.
Yeah.
Would he didn't have an academic background, as I recall.
Ozan?
Hmm.
Hmm.
At least this is, it seems to me that's what Ed Young said.
Yeah, I don't know what he was doing at the time.
Those were the files I happened to look through, the School for Worker files, and even before Ozan came, you were having quite a time in Wausau, I guess it was. Do you remember some business people were criticizing the School for Workers, and they were, somebody named Lepas, remember him? Lepas, he was a teacher.
No.
In the School for Workers, and they were saying that he was teaching things that weren't true about business, and you went up to a meeting in Wausau to try and iron it out?
I have just the vaguest recollection of that. Somewhat later, we had a much more difficult one up at Fond du Lac, which in order to straighten out, even one of the regents went with me.
Oh, really?
To straighten it out, yeah, and it was straightened out all right.
Do you remember which regent went with you?
Yeah, I sure do. It was old Sensenbrenner.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He was one of the very pro-industry people, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, very, very. He was chairman of the board, I think, at that time of Kimberly-Clark.
Huh.
And,
Well, did you and he get along all right?
Yeah.
Because he didn't like the School for Workers very much.
He didn't really like it, but he did come to its defense when they got in trouble up there.
He did?
Yeah. He really told those business people off.
Huh.
Yeah. Well, where would you like me to go now?
Well, And E.B. Fred got involved in some of the worker problems.
Sure.
So, and I'm very interested in your period under him. Apparently, you met with him regularly, isn't that right?
Oh, yes. Well, I worked with him the longest of any of the presidents. And the real development of extension that took place during a period of about 10 years was due in large part to his support. Mm. He didn't give a positive support or direction, but he just backed up whatever he wanted to do. He, by the way, was a very peculiar man to deal with. I don't know if you knew him.
No. I just, when he was much older.
He was, he'd call you up to his office, say, at 9 o'clock. And I'd always tell my secretary, well, don't expect me back before noon. Because you'd sit there and you'd wait and wait and wait. And then when you got to see him, he'd be fiddling around with half a dozen other things and what you were there for. And he was a very odd man, but he was superb at dealing with the regents. Just superb. And well, let me go back to extension just in broad terms. If I made any contribution there, I think a major one would be the development of the whole institute and conference program, which now, of course, is housed in the center building. I suppose I'd maybe been there a year when I began thinking about the possibilities of expanding our institute and conference program, which at that point was negligible, with the possible exception of the Management Institute, which had been started, the School for Workers, and that was it. Gosh, I guess I better get the phone.
Okay.
So we began systematically creating programs in all of the professional fields, as well as some in letters and science, such as Bureau of Government, in connection with the Political Science Department. And simultaneously, we began building up our departments and tying them into the residence departments, mm-hmm. so that all of our department heads had joint appointments in residence and in extension. I think we probably wound up with some 32 such split appointments. Other members of our staff, with rare exceptions, were not split. They were wholly in extension. But we had this fixed policy that extension should be intimately related to residents, and that was the mechanism that seemed most promising. Didn't really turn out that way. It'd been my hope that we would get considerable extension work done by regular resident staff, but that never really worked.
How do you mean that they would have done more of the teaching?
Yeah, that they and would. That they would do some both credit and non-credit work out in the state, correspondence study. Well, a good many did correspondence study, but very few did the other extension work.
It was just too much for them? They weren't interested?
I think so. They just didn't want to travel satisfied, I guess they should be, with their residence jobs.
Did they get any extra money for being joint appointments with extension?
No, not if it was a joint appointment. Hmm. But they did a good many things on an overload basis, and then they got paid extra for it.
Because there wouldn't be much incentive to do a lot if you were already working full-time.
Well,
your own job.
If on these split appointments, they might be, let's say, 50-50.
Oh, I see.
In which case, extension paid 50% of the salary.
Oh, so they should have been working 50%
of
their time.
Yeah, that's right. And then residents paid the other 50, and they would teach maybe a couple of classes for that 50% in residence, and then do whatever was necessary in extension.
Were these people, I know Lester Seifert is one of them, isn't he,
mm-hmm.
in German. Were these people, they had already been on the faculty, is that right? Or were they hired at that time? And then
it worked both ways. In some cases, they were already on the faculty. Herb Evans, for instance, in math, was a full professor in mathematics, LNS.
I see.
And then came with us part-time. But others were hired by agreement between residents and extension. Bob Mulvihill, for instance, is a good example. He was brought in on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
And then went on to other things.
You said this was of something you felt a particular contribution of yours. Was it your idea to have these joint appointments?
No, not entirely. It was my idea to push them, though, as far as possible into every department. There were, as I recall, two or three joint appointments at the time I took over. Of course, extension changed so drastically from just a correspondence study program with very few classes to a very large class program and institutes and conferences, you know. Ultimately, we were running them by the hundreds every year. So that, well, in any case, I think that was certainly one of my major contributions to Extension.
But your idea was to get better quality teaching, is that, I suppose?
Yes, and much more of it, much more diversified. Meanwhile, too, the centers were coming along.
Yes, go ahead, say that again.
The centers were coming along after World War II. There was the tremendous pressure of returning servicemen coming to school under the GI Bill, and in order to satisfy the need, you might say, we developed some 34 centers. That's the maximum number we had at any given time. These were still all housed in, not all, mostly housed in local vocational schools that provided the space, sometimes a small library. And then we provided the instruction, of course. But about or a little bit later, Racine County, county and city, decided that they'd like a building or a campus for the Racine Center. And they turned over to us an old elementary school, which is right in the heart of town, the old McMinn School, I think it was called. And there we put in laboratories and other equipment and established really the first campus of the center system. We also developed a policy for dealing with local communities on the development of centers, which was that the local community had to provide the land and the building, and had to maintain the building too. And the university provided all the equipment, libraries, of course, and the instruction programs. And that's a policy that's held down to the present day.
Who, do you remember how that came about? How, who thought of it, and why it came up?
Well, we I think it's a policy that just sort of evolved as we were dealing with communities, but it was a policy early in the game because I think our first campus was at Sheboygan, other than Racine. And there the policy was pretty clean cut. And most county boards were quite friendly to it, and so it stuck. The only place we had any real trouble with it was in Waukesha.
Where, what happened there?
Oh, two or three county board members, they were in a minority. They were very vocal, objected vehemently to the county having to put up the building. And we had quite a battle in the county board over it. But the majority went out, and we got quite a handsome campus in Waukesha out of it.
Henry Arnsbach, I've interviewed him.
Mm-hmm.
Was he one of your outstanding people, or was were there many like him?
No, there weren't many just like him.
I don't.
Yes, he was an outstanding one. He how should I put it? He was the first dean to negotiate a new building, and a new building built from scratch, and he did it just superbly. He had an extraordinary sense of how to deal with county board people and others in the community. Was very community oriented, and handled that campus extremely well in its expansion phases and whatnot. So I would say yes, he was quite a rare bird.
Did people like him, did they come in and talk with you and about their plans? How close was your supervision? I suppose you were in charge of them, were you?
Well, we did have a director of what we called the freshman sophomore program at that time.
That's right. His name was
Wilbur Hanley.
Hanley.
Yeah. And he did, or he handled much of the relations with them, but I was always involved when it came to new buildings or mm-hmm. new construction, expansion, and so on. Oh, I'd say that I talked to most of the deans every day. Almost every day. Oh, yeah.
By telephone, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
Did they keep you posted on any new crises or?
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, if it was likely to be a really major blow up, they'd probably hot footed down to Madison.
Oh, is that right?
Talk about it. Sure, sure. And I went out a good deal, too.
Uh-huh.
So that we were in constant touch.
I didn't realize you used the term deans for these people.
Well, they've been deans now for quite a while. They were directors.
Uh-huh.
But we changed the title to dean. Well, I pretty much did that. I didn't like the title director out in the community. I thought dean sounded better.
Mm.
That it'd give the job a little more prestige.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether it did or not, but anyway, that's how I felt. So with the Wausau addition, we began then the building of new campuses. And I think we built either 12 or 13, I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. Although we wound up with seven, because some were split apart with the state colleges and then subsequently merged again, so that they must have some 13 at the present time. Oh, well, more than that, you count the state college campuses. I'm not sure of that number.
The state colleges were training teachers.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were broader than that, really. But basically, yes, they were training teachers.
I know there was competition between the state colleges and extension, but, I mean, you hear that, but I'm never clear as to how it expressed itself.
Well, it expressed itself in conflicts in locating extension classes. For instance, our education department want to put a class in education, let's say down in Beloit, and Whitewater come down there at the same time, want to put the identical class in down there. And
Whitewater being a teacher's college.
A teacher's college at that time, yeah. And that happened in quite frequently over the state, though. We developed a policy that wasn't completely adhered to of backing out of any situation of that kind, letting them prevail, though the teachers who were being served, I think, generally preferred a university course.
Mm, I suppose so.
Yeah, to a teacher's college course. So that was something of a problem, though. Probably not as serious as it looked at the time. Mm. Well, let me see. The best president I worked with was Fred Harrington.
Oh, that's interesting.
He he took quite an interest in extension, for one thing. And he liked to see things done, and we got along very well. So that was a very happy arrangement.
You were made the you were called the provost to begin with.
Yeah.
In 1964. How did you feel about that? I mean, you were losing extension.
Yeah.
But it was more, were you glad to be in charge of the campuses?
Yes. Well, I had a choice. Harrington was president. And he, at that time, was again back on the possibility of merging ag and general extension. And as a part of that, prior to doing that, he felt that the centers should be a system of their own, that their chances of developing would be better if they were in a unit of their own rather than as a part of extension,
mm-hmm.
which I happen to think is true. So when he was ready to propose that to the regents, he asked me whether I'd rather stay on as dean of extension or go with the center system. And I chose the center system.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I knew that there would be a period of 8 to 10 years at least of real development
mm-hmm.
in the centers and building new campuses and all that, which appealed to me. And so that's the way it went.
Was this something, a job that Hanley might have expected to get?
Yeah, he did expect to get.
He did.
Sad situation.
Was he not very good at it? At what he'd been doing?
I'd rather not say.
All right.
I'd just soon not talk about Bill Hanley. He was a very serious problem for us. The president told me several times, in fact, to fire him. Not to fire him out of that job, but he'd get his job. He was a geographer, but, and put him in a job in the geography department. Well, I'd worked with him so long, and while we weren't really close friends, I couldn't get myself to do it. So finally, Harrington did.
Huh.
He took it on himself. He said, I'm not supposed to be meddling like this, but if you won't do it, he said, I'm going to do it. And he did.
He didn't create this change in order to make you the head of the...
No, but... as I said, he gave me the choice then between extension and the new center system.
You know, as we look at it now, or maybe you don't look at it that way, it seems as if there were too many centers built in the with falling enrollments and this desperate economic straits, that it might have been better if some of them hadn't been started, but maybe you don't see it that way.
No, I don't. I don't know too much about the state university campuses. I think probably there are a couple in their system that are too small, should not have been started. But of those that the university started, they're all... Even the smallest ones, like Baraboo, are up around 600 students.
Mm-hmm.
And we always figured if you could have 300 students, then you'd have a viable operation.
Hmm.
Baraboo's around 600. I think Marinette's around 600. And they're the two smallest. I worked, of course, with Elvium, too, when he was president. He, too, gave me a completely free hand. And I didn't see very much of him. He didn't call you in very often.
suppose he was terribly preoccupied with the medical school
Oh,
situation.
Yes. Job killed him.
Yeah,
the job killed him. He was so serious a person, too. But, and then, well, we've talked a little about Harrington.
Did Harrington, did you meet with him regularly?
Quite frequently.
Was it just you and he, or were the all the, let's see.
Both ways. I met with him quite often, alone. Well, I got to know him very well when he was vice president, and he handled pretty much the day-to-day operation of the university. And so I had occasion to see him quite often. And then after he became president, I would see him quite often. But then there were meetings, of chancellor's meetings and, that we had, I don't recall now, at least once a month. And,
that would be you and the Madison campus chancellor and the Milwaukee campus chancellor.
Milwaukee and Parkside and Racine.
Oh, yes. Were you talking about particular issues or problems that you, one or somebody, one of you might have and the other's talking, or what, or would you be just reporting on what you were doing?
Well, mainly, you mean in the chancellor's meetings?
Mm.
Well, if the chancellor had a problem that he thought needed discussion with the president and the group, he'd usually mail it in or call it in, and then the president would have things, and he'd have a sort of agenda,
mm-hmm.
and we'd go through that.
Harrington's agenda. Pretty well organized, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And oh, we'd usually meet for at least 2 hours.
Hmm.
They were good meetings, interesting meetings.
Do you remember some of the things that most, any particular problems that you had, or policies that you were debating that would stand out in your mind?
No, that's odd that I shouldn't. No, I can't think of any.
Which of them stand out as people to you of the chancellors that you knew?
Well, Fleming would be one when he was chancellor of the Madison campus.
Of course, he had the beginnings of the student protest movement. Did
yeah.
he ever bring that to the meetings?
Oh,
did you
yeah.
ever discuss that?
Yes.
What would be the sense of the meeting?
Well, it was always a question of what kind of action you should take if and when, you know, this occurred. And the general agreement was that you should be firm, but not go out of your way to cause trouble or incite things or anything. The chancellor chancellors as a group were an interesting... Joe Clocci was chancellor in Milwaukee, of course, for a long time. He was... he had a good sense of humor and didn't always seem to be on top of things, but I think that was deceiving. I think he really was. Ed Widener, who was still at Green Bay, played things awful close to his vest. He never wanted to discuss anything involving Green Bay. He said that was his business. It was none of our business. Irv Wiley was down at Racine, but died. Was a very open, somewhat argumentative guy. Really able fellow. I guess that was the original group. Ed Young, of course, was in it after he became, he was chancellor of the Madison campus.
There was Sewell in between. Do you remember Bill Sewell?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know Bill very well. He was in, a year or so?
Yes, just a year.
Yeah. Right.
Did you talk to him about about the Dow protest? Do you remember that?
I remember it. No, I don't remember talking about it. My office, you know, was down on State Street. And when they had these protest marches and whatnot, we were really in trouble there. In fact, they smashed all our windows one night.
Where on State Street?
Huh?
Where on State Street?
602. We were above McNeil and Moore when they were down there.
I see.
We had the second floor of that building. Not the whole second floor, but yeah. Yeah, that's where my offices were. And, those were tough times down there.
That was not Extension didn't have, or the other campuses. Well, I guess there were some. Oshkosh, is Oshkosh one of the centers, or that's
a
state college?
No, that's State University.
I see.
Oh, yes, there were others. We had some minor protests. We had a little bit down at Janesville, as a matter of fact. But they didn't amount to very much. It's a little different when you have two-year campuses and mostly students living at home.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't act quite the same way.
I'd like to go back to the period under E.B. Fred. You were meeting at that time, it would have been with other deans, wouldn't it, of the Dean of Agriculture and Engineering?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be very interesting to hear what you'd have to say about them and how Fred conducted the meetings. I don't know quite what to ask you about it, but did you meet daily, for instance, with E.B. Fred?
No, not daily, no. No, but frequently.
And all of you?
Well, we met, as I recall, once a week.
Once a week, all right.
Once a week,
that must be,
yeah.
I'm thinking of.
And um, recall, E.B. Fred conducted those meetings very well. And unlike when you were visiting with him alone. But, yeah, those meetings. Most articulate dean, I think, was Kurt Wendt of engineering.
Oh. More so than Mark Ingram.
Yeah, in meetings like that, yeah.
Do you mean articulate in the sense of expressing what he wanted for engineering, or?
Well, no, just talking a lot.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, ideas about everything. And, of course, he was head of the campus planning commission, so he was in on a lot of things. That was a tough job, by the
way.
Yeah, that was a really tough job.
Was he talking about, did you have the sense that he was, well, maybe interfering is too strong a word, but did he want to know what all of you were doing and comment on it? And is that the sort of thing?
Well, yeah, he'd comment on almost everything that came up. The quietest dean was Dean Middleton.
Oh.
In the medical school. He never said anything.
Huh.
He was my next door neighbor for 15 years, I guess.
Really?
Over on Adams Street.
So you might have known him quite well, did you?
No, I didn't know him well. No. We never did more than say hello. And I was in his home just once.
Huh.
In that time.
What? Why?
Well, he was a very reticent. I think now, looking back, that he was a very shy man.
Hmm.
Although he didn't give that appearance. And he was another one who was all business. At medical school and hospital.